This is tape 3 of the PDH Online audio course E315, something about HVAC controls. Let's look at pump room control panel. You don't have a picture, so you're going to have to trust me on this. There are groups of three lights with a selector switch below them. And how many groups do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 groups. So there are 9 pumps, let's call them that, that are being operated in this form. And in the middle, there's a control alarm, or general alarm, and lamp test. Okay. There are groups of three lights, off, on, and trouble. That's what the three lights are. The middle four items are cooling tower pumps, cooling tower fan, and the heater for the catch tank, handoff auto also. The other groups are process pumps, and we're not going to talk about process pumps, all proprietary. The center light is common trouble, and the button is lamp test. The center functions are PLC and not on the as-built drawings. This brings up the very large indicator panel. And really, there's value in looking at the picture. Not while you're driving, please. When you get back home, see if you've got it on your hard drive or if you can download it. But this large panel is impressive. I mean, this thing is 6 foot high, looks to be at least 30 inches wide, and it's got lots of lights on it. Got no buttons on it, got lots of lights. And these four strip charts along the top. Formal name is Pump Room Indicator and HVAC Annunciator Panel, even though it appears to have no genuine annunciator functions beyond run status. I've got two pictures in the text. One is the top half of it, and the other is the bottom half of it. It fills the frame on the top half, and it's kind of nice. You can actually read the legends on this. Now, again, I haven't seen how well it goes into the PDF. You may not know this, but you can adjust the resolution on a PDF. You can get very fine resolution and very large file size, or fairly coarse resolution. It looks a lot like a fax, and very small file size. And I don't know how they set them up at PDH Online. I've never complained about it. I've never heard anybody complain about it. Either they use the factory defaults or they adjust it in a nice way. I can read it on the original I sent them. Rows and rows, four rows of lots of lights at the bottom. And let's see what the narration says. Notice the Z-fold strip chart recorders along the top. Each displays three process variables and records each with a different color ink. This gives a marvelous insight into what is important to the client and to the plant operators. The strip charts themselves cost as much as a PLC. That's each strip chart costs as much as a PLC. The paper is a major continuing expense, and it's a serious bother to keep the pens working and the windows clean. They made the original investment and the continuing investments to keep them running. The inputs are called process variables, but in this case, they are header pressures and cooling tower temperature. Sidebar, what is a header? Well, when you generate steam to run a plant, you run all of your boilers into a manifold and distribute from the manifold. The manifold is a shared place to keep track of the pressure, which is the prime measure of how satisfactory steam service is. Carryover solids is a quality measure and also has a corresponding measure for other process fluids. Easy way to measure other than water in steam is by pH of the condensate return. Distribution manifold is commonly called the steam header. Same terminology is used on the main high pressure and low pressure manifolds or supply pipes in the plant. In this particular plant, they had high pressure gas that they used in part of the process, and they had low pressure gas they used in part of the process. So you got a regulator between the two. Well, they had a strip chart recorder on the high pressure side, and they had a strip chart recorder on the low pressure side. So if there's problems with the process, you can go back and see if there was problems with the natural gas at that time, or any of the process gases, or the cooling water. That's what the strip charts are about. There are natural gas headers, and those are two more inputs for the strip charts. The remaining indicators and recording channels are dedicated to compressed air, processed gases, and cooling tower temperature. The bottom photograph shows rows and rows of indicator lights, almost all of which are red and represent an operating problem. The white lights also represent trouble indicators without higher or lower priority. The lights are from individual field switches or relays attached to standalone control panels. Another sidebar. Why two control panels and a very large indicator panel? The HVAC control panel was in the electric room next to the HVAC control motor control center. Pump room control panel was in the pump room next to the pump room motor control center. The very large indicator panel was on the plant floor just outside the process control room. Yes, this is redundant. I told you about that before. The 1993 HVAC control scheme. Well, in 1993, electrical designers had to know how the HVAC equipment worked. The electrical designer created the logic diagrams and instructions for contractors to install the wires. The electrical designer had to answer field calls and visit the site to get the HVAC operating. Now, wait a minute. What does that mean? Those are just words. That doesn't convey a message. There's a lot of pieces and parts in an HVAC system. The old way to hook them up was to have the electrical designer hook them up. He had to know how they worked, show how the wires go together, and tell the electrical contractor how to put them together. Well, today there are even more pieces and parts, but nobody has to know anything about them because they're all inside the box. We got this idea called single point power, where you must specify this when you buy equipment, but you buy equipment with single point power. Then it has three terminals for phases A, B, and C, and there are no more wiring connections. All of the controls are inside the box. You don't have to hook up a pressure switch. You don't have to hook up a dirty fan switch. You don't have to hook up an over-temperature switch on the burner. Well, back in 1993, they had to hook up all those things. So it was a very complicated control scheme in 1993. Now, I'd say that, but ordinary people were maintaining it. So, you know, it's something you and I could do if we wanted to invest a lot of effort in it. It's just, it's so nice to have it from the factory, something they've proven in hundreds of installations. You don't have to invent anything. And they have factory-trained servicemen that know when it acts this way, this is what you fix. You don't have to train your own electricians, and when he moves on to a better job, train a new electrician. Well, as I was saying, today these functions are handled by HVAC designers, but they're handled in the form of a performance specification. We want to deliver 65 degree air when the outside temperature is 30 degrees F, and we want 5,000 CFM under these design conditions. Okay, and then the manufacturer figures out what he has to put in the box to make it work and what safeties he has to put in to satisfy the government requirements. Unit manufacturers respond to mechanical specification. Temperature control contractors respond to mechanical specifications. They hook up the remote devices. A lot of times you do have a remote thermostat. Okay, that's too complicated for a mechanical technician. It's too complicated for an electrical technician. We need a temperature control contractor to hook up the thermostat. Now, if it sounds like I'm being facetious and excessive, that's true, because HVAC can get very, very complicated, and gets complicated fast. Let me give you an example of the most complicated job I ever worked on. It's a laboratory. Whoa, how come you're working on a laboratory? Well, the guy's doing a wastewater treatment plant, and they've got to test the water in a wastewater treatment plant. They've got to have a pretty decent laboratory in both a clean water plant and in a wastewater plant. Now, one of the things in a laboratory is you worry about toxic gases because they generate them when they put this stuff on this stuff and it foams, you know, like on TV. Sometimes they'll even have tank of toxic gases right in there that they use for whatever the hell it is they do in laboratories for wastewater treatment plants. Well, what do you do with these toxic gases? Well, you have to have a supply fan. You have to have an exhaust fan. You have to have makeup air unit, because if you're exhausting a lot of air, which you really want to do if it's toxic, if you want to exhaust a lot of air, you've got to temper the air coming in, warm it up so you don't freeze the guy. And then it gets worse because they have a hood. These guys don't want to get gassed to death, so they put it under a hood with a really fine airflow in it. Except hoods are different when the door is open and when the door is closed. When the door is closed, they suck air through them. They have little vents, so they keep the air flowing when the door is closed. But they suck a whole heck of a lot more air when the door is open. And if you think about this, you just want to create a flow when the door is closed. You don't want to mess up whatever they're doing in there, the testing. But when it's open, you want to make sure the air is going into the exhaust hood, not into the room. So they increase the CFM a lot. Well, balancing the supply air, the supply air, the exhaust fan, the variable speed fan on the hood, and the makeup air unit is a hairy mess. There are companies that make special controllers for exactly this function. If you're writing anything down, again, not at 65 miles an hour on the highway, Phoenix is the brand of the people who do it best. You can buy it from a lot of people, but almost all of them are made by Phoenix. And if it's not made by Phoenix, you're getting an inferior product. Those are people who have really figured it out, and they have an excellent reputation in the field. A typical exhaust fan looks like this. We're doing pictures again. And this is intended to be a simplified sketch where there's a fan symbol going through the wall, and it's blowing it out the wall. There's a motor driving the fan. There's a starter driving the motor. And there's a handoff auto switch driving the starter. And this is just a picture of what we talked about previously. A representation is a very common form found in industrial and commercial occupancies. The fan is on a steel frame bolted to the outside wall. It has a motor, either direct drive or belted. The power wiring goes to a starter with a handoff auto selector switch in the door. In very small sizes, the motor is 120 volts. This starter is a special off-on switch in a wall box. Also, many small exhaust fans are self-protected and don't require an external starter, just the wall switch. Let me say that again, because sometimes my eyes glaze over when this thing stuff's going through here, and it doesn't quite make sense. Okay, starter is for a big fan, goes ker-chunk, and the electricity flows through it, and the fan starts. Okay, you got the idea of a starter, and the switch makes it go. The same thing happens on a smaller fan. You got to have a switch to turn it on and off. By the way, by law, you have to have either a switch or a plug you can pull, turn it off. You've got to have a way to turn it off. Okay. On a small fan, typically you have a starter with overload protection. They make these little itty-bitty starters with overload protection that fit in a switch box. What am I talking about? If you take the cover off the switch and you see something fairly complicated in there, it's called a manual motor starter. Now, industrial, a lot of times we'll put them in a sheet metal box next to the fan, but they can be mounted in the wall box in a bathroom. Okay, that is a motor starter, and that is required for a fan that's going to try to grind itself to death if the bearings go out. A motor that's smart enough to trip off by itself if the bearings fail is called a self-protected motor. It's got a little thermostat inside that opens the wiring when it overheats. It's self-protected. It's got the overloads built into the motor, self-protected motor. They don't require the motor starter, they just require the switch, because you still got to be able to turn it off. And once again, it is legal to start and stop it by plugging it into the wall, but let's not talk that way. You certainly don't want to do that in an industrial plant. The sketch represents exhaust fans we've been talking about, but it's not accurate for 1993. In 1993, someone in charge decided the exhaust fans must have powered duct dampers to lock out the outside air when not in service. This may have been the result of the climate where the process was originally installed. The sketch is like this. Now remember we had the fan that was blowing through the wall. Now we've got something in the duct between the fan and the wall. And this is a damper, and it's shown as they're available in two types. One that's just a big thing that turns, and the other a thing that opens from the middle, open and closed, and I don't know why they use one or the other. But they've got a shaft coming out of them and a little tiny motor that turns them around. Back when I started playing the game, it was a Honeywell Modutrol. Oh, those were beautiful machines. Turned out my neighbor was the manager of the plant that made them. He brought one home for me to play with. I had to give it back to him. But it's a gear motor, and it takes power in and drives a little motor, whir, 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 and then it turns it down to 1 RPM. Well, it opens and closes this little flap that stops the air when you want it to be cold outside and warm inside. And it opens it when you want the warm air to go outside and exhaust the room. So, what have we got? We've got the motor starter that turns on the fan. We've got a motor that gets 120 volts to crank open. And then we've got an end of travel limit switch on the motor so we know when it's full open. And the way this is done, you open the damper first. When the damper is full open, it tells the motor starter it's okay to start. Now in this sketch, there's also a second one here that where that we've stretched out the duct even farther and put a smoke detector in this duct on the exhaust fan. And if that sounds a little peculiar to you, it sounds a little peculiar to me too, and we're going to discuss that. Please visualize for a moment a 3-horsepower industrial exhaust fan. It converts 3 horsepower of energy into mechanical force to move air. To overcome this force, a motor is required to open the duct damper. Because of the force involved, it's better to open the damper first before serious friction is created by the fan pressure. Use a limit switch to sense the damper's full open and permit the exhaust fan to come on. There are a range of ways to accomplish this, including gravity dampers that use some of the fan force to hold the dampers open, and local logic on the fan power circuit. Most common 1980 method was to power the damper motor from the motor starter and use the limit switch in the starter circuit to inhibit the exhaust fan until the damper was full open. 1993 method in the original plant installation was a hybrid of this in the PLC, which we shall study in some detail. The second, even more complicated sketch above, is a 2005 standard detail from a major international engineering firm. I don't know why they have a smoke detector in the exhaust air duct. The HVAC designer working on my project didn't know. The chief mechanical engineer from the branch didn't know. No one was willing to call the corporate office and ask. We put in several hundred exhaust fans in water treatment plants, each with a smoke detector. Now, please keep in mind that water treatment plants are concrete and water and a little bit of steel. There is something humorous about protecting them so aggressively from fire. Errata, missing disconnect safety switches on fan power leads. In 1993, it was the duty of the electrical designer to provide a disconnect safety switch in the fan power leads right at the fan. When the fan size changed, the electrical had to make sure his wire size and switch were big enough for the new fan. This was a critical safety item and a favorite change order request from the installing contractor if the designer missed it. In 2009, exhaust and supply fans are ordered with factory-installed disconnect safety switches. It is the duty of the electrical designer to verify the HVAC ordering information, usually contained in a note on the HVAC equipment schedule sheet. Since it's now internal to the fan, I have not been showing the disconnect safety switch on these sketches. And by the way, my boss told me last week to put the safety disconnect switches on each of the fans. Now, I told you this went out for bid. It did go out for bid, but we're issuing an addendum. There is a period between the bid set and the bid date where you can make changes for free. The changes for free are called addendum or addenda. After the bid date, when he's committed on a price, you can still make changes, but they're called bulletins and they cost money. Let's talk about a typical supply fan. Following sketch, okay, we're going to try and communicate graphics again, is our detailed discussion of supply fans. What we've got is the fan symbol, but it's inside the room and it's blowing into the room. It's sucking air through the wall. Okay, that's the inlet side of the fan. We've got a damper on the inlet here. We've got an air filter on the inlet. And we've got a differential pressure switch across the high side and the low side of the air filter. And what does that mean? Well, the air is flowing through it in a direction. The direction where it comes in is called the high side. Where it comes out is called the low side because there's a pressure drop across the filter. As you collect more dirt in the filter, there's more pressure drop. When you collect enough dirt that it's seriously impeding the flow of air, then it operates the switch. Usually the switch just operates a light, tells somebody to work on it. It does not shut down the fan. Fan's still working. It's just working in diminished capacity. It should be. It wouldn't be working any better if you turned it off. In this one, we have a smoke detector on the discharge side of it. There was something especially silly I was going to point out to you, and I'm not seeing it now. Well, maybe it really wasn't all that silly. The inlet damper has an end of travel limit switch also. Sketch shows exactly what was specified and installed in 1993. In 2009, there is no air filter, no differential pressure switch around the filter to indicate dirt buildup, no smoke detector. The inlet damper motor and end of travel limit switch have remained. Oh, I remember what I was going to tell you about filters. Here is a silly fact, strange but true. Filters don't work as good when they're new as when they've started to crud up. Now, if you think about this, it's obvious. When it's new, it's just got those little strands in there that are supposed to catch particles. But after it's partially crudded up, it's got the strands and a bunch of crud particles there. So it's got a much finer mesh than it had originally. I mean, just guaranteed, if you think in mind about a crosshatch with two going one way and two going the other way, it's got a hole in it. That's what the opening is for the air to go through. If you think of those two with the same size opening, except half of the opening is covered by a crud particle, well, obviously, you're going to catch smaller pieces because you don't have as much hole available. And then, of course, you go too far, you get too much crud, and nothing's going through, so you're not doing the fan function any longer. But clean filters are a bad thing. It's dirtier with a clean filter than it is with a dirty filter because you catch more of the particulates when it is partially crudded up. Isn't that bizarre? I think the extent of enunciation in 1993 now becomes more reasonable. They had 6 supply fans and 5 makeup air units, each containing filter alarms, smoke alarms. They also had some, I guess differential pressure was the filter alarm. They had some other strange pressure switches. I think they were worried about overpressuring the space, so they were measuring the pressure in the space versus the pressure outside. It's something we did not make any attempt to duplicate in 2009. Handled by electric controls. They had a lot of lights, but also a lot of interconnecting wires if they hadn't used the PLC. By the way, it was mentioned in passing previously that many different arrangements of fan components are commercially available, and even more through field fabrication. The sketch shown is typical and representative of a large number of installations observed close-hand by your author. We've got a discussion coming up on alarm lights and enunciation, and I think it's a story you'll enjoy, so please come back after this break, or keep it going on the next section if you choose.